Hello, my name is Dave Emery, and this is Side 1 of For the Record program number 711, interview with Russ Baker, author of Family of Secrets. And it is my pleasure and privilege to bring to our airwaves, not for the last time, I hope, Russ Baker, the author of Family of Secrets, out in soft cover now by Bloomsbury Press. Russ, welcome to our airwaves.
Thank you very much, Dave. Great to be here. May I mention the subtitle of the book?
Sure, please.
It's The Bush Dynasty, America's Invisible Government, and the Hidden History of the Last 50 Years.
Very good. And we're going to do what we can, what you've already done a magnificent job of doing, to boost into view that hidden history, or as much of it as we reasonably can on the air, and as much as you could in an almost 500-page book. I'd like to begin this interview with something that you talked about in the afterword of your book, and that is the professional stigma, and a very powerful stigma it is, that attaches to someone that investigates some of the things that you have looked into, including, for example, the Kennedy assassination, another major conspiratorial event inextricably linked with the Kennedy assassination, Watergate, and other things. And you mentioned that some of your esteemed professional associates, people who had actually assisted you with parts of the research, but who also invade to an extent, perhaps gently, against going forward past a point. And I think you bring up the issue of investigative reporting versus, quote, conspiracy theory as it is conceptualized or as it is stigmatized. Develop that for us, if you would, and then I have my own afterword to that thought. Go ahead.
Sure, and if I may just back up for a moment, I think it's important at the outset for anyone who may not be familiar with Family of Secrets to explain that this was an authentic inquiry into a very simple, broad question to which I did not know the answer, and that was, how did somebody like George W. Bush get to the top and do the things that he did? And I was genuinely curious about that, and I didn't know what I would find, if I would find anything, if there were any more profound explanations than we'd already been privy to. And this led me into a five-year odyssey, which led me in all kinds of directions that I know you're going to be going into. And I wanted to just say that to contextualize these conversations, because people obviously hearing the subtitle about the Bushes say, well, why would you be talking about the Kennedy assassination? And of course, when I began this research, there would have been no reason to do it. But I started following trails. I started trying to understand who George W. Bush was, and then larger questions about his family and their rise to power and the circles with which they were associated. And this led me into these very much sort of dark alleys and down rabbit holes where I began having to kind of analyze and rethink whole portions of American history. And so that's the backstory. Now, as to the issue you raise of concern about going into certain topics, I think that all of us in the mainstream media, and I sort of have always straddled the line between what you'd call mainstream media and alternative media, we're always aware, sort of at least in the back of our mind, that there are topics that when you begin talking about them, right away you have problems. You have professional problems. You have problems being dismissed by certain, let's say, critics, by some portions of the public. And that really relates to this notion of whether or not there are larger causations, whether or not there are larger networks of influence and of power that shape events. And as you, I'm sure you know, Dave, and I know you talk about and you look into these things, the United States has very much a notion of itself which is somewhat idealized, and that is that although we know that all these terrible things go on in the rest of the world, and although we know that even our own country has been deeply involved in many of these things, and even the sponsor of so many of them, all documented in testimony and hearings and all sorts of confessionals, we still have trouble believing that any of those kind of awful things could also take place on home ground. And that really is where, when you begin exploring those possibilities, you encounter a tremendous amount of resistance and a tremendous amount of cognitive dissonance from Americans of all kinds.
One of the interesting things about the issues that you have dealt with very successfully, and you've already brought up a word I'm going to touch on in a second, but when one brings up the topic or utters the phrase conspiracy theory, right away it is so stigmatized, and it causes a rolling of the eyes. And in many ways, from a professional standpoint, it is sociologically fascistic, in the sense of there are the twin fundamentals of inclusion or exclusion. And if you want to make it professionally, you cannot talk about, quote, conspiracy theory, because one is automatically excluded. And in some ways, it's almost adolescent. And it's like, you know, the young man or young woman who's not good to associate with because they're not dating or whatever, or they have the wrong physiological type, or even juvenile, where we can't play with Johnny or we can't play with Janie because they have cooties. And it's really very powerful. And I don't think that people who decline to joust with the dragon that you have slain, and I think you've done a good job, I don't think they are to be faulted past a point. I, on the other hand, long ago chose to wear the scarlet letter of conspiracy theorist, and believe me, you know, to coin a phrase, you don't get paid and you don't get laid. So it's not a lot of fun. What you have done in a very, very good way, a remarkable way, is to illustrate what I think it is all about. If one avoids the term conspiracy theory and uses another term, which you have illustrated abundantly, and that is networking, has a very different stigma to it, a very different connotation, and one that is not negative, and one that I think really goes to the substance of your book, Family of Secrets. When you talk about the Bush family as the family of secrets, when one talks about the subtitle of your book, The Bush Dynasty, America's Invisible Government, and the Hidden History of the Last 50 Years, I don't think there is anything that you have illustrated more profoundly than networking. And when you ask the question, how did W come to be? How did Bush happen? He happened because of networking between the intelligence community and the political establishment, and in turn the corporate establishment, the all business, as they say in Texas in particular. And so kudos to you, because rather than a conspiracy theorist, I would classify you as a networking theorist. And you've done a whole lot more than just theorize, and you deserve a lot of credit for it.
Well, I pride myself on the fact that the bulk of my work over the quarter century that I've been doing journalism, and particularly investigative journalism, is driven almost entirely by documented facts. And this, I think, distinguishes my work from that of many other people. A lot of folks have trouble understanding the difference, that the difference between opinion and conclusion and simply laying out things that are not in dispute but have never been laid out together or are not well known. And so with Family of Secrets, I just started encountering the most extraordinary facts. And these were things that were admissions by the people themselves in little-known, privately published memoirs. These were transcripts of conversations. They were documents that had long remained hidden and then been, perhaps accidentally, declassified. They were a matter of connecting dots between lots of circumstances that themselves didn't seem that interesting. And so when you do that, what you do is you end up with some sort of picture begins to appear from all these dots. And that's where, when you're talking about theory of some sort, is, you know, the reader starts saying, okay, now tell me what this means, or what do you think it means? And so what I do in Family of Secrets is I create these narratives, and I work pretty hard to try to weave it into a kind of a dramatic, almost like a spy story. Somebody called it Ludlum on steroids. You know, just a very lively narrative rendition of people doing something in a plot building. But it's made up of these thousands of data points. And then every so often I stop and I say, okay, what do we have here? What do we think this means? Could it mean this? Could it mean that? It certainly seems to mean something. And I try very hard not to go too much beyond that and let the reader come to their own conclusions.
Russ Baker, in your book, Family of Secrets, again, for listeners who may have just tuned in, subtitled The Bush Dynasty, America's Invisible Government, and the Hidden History of the Last 50 Years, you illustrate networks, and the Bush family, for generations, have been both beneficiaries of these networks and also people who advanced the causes of these networks in a fundamental way. Let's go back to the early part of the last century, Russ, and let's talk about some of the, well, what C. Wright Mills referred to as the power elite. Let's talk about the Harriman family, let's talk about the Walkers, and let's talk about the Bushes, and how they began to network coming out of the Gilded Age and going into World War One. Tell us a little bit about some of these families. Again, Walkers, Harrimans.
The Dulleses, the Rockefellers, the Morgans. You know, we know about these families. If we read books, we see there are these huge histories of these families. But most of those books don't really go into the subterranean element. But, you know, the way you start seeing it is I went back, as I always do when I do this sort of research, and I did a lot of historical digging into, for example, newspaper clippings, and you see who's staying at whose house, who are all together for dinner at a, and sitting at a particular table together in Palm Beach, who are all together at a wedding, who are sitting on the board of directors of a particular bank and a particular charity and so forth, who are intermarrying, who are swapping blocks of stock. And so you start seeing these connections, and you start understanding who knows who and who works with who. And this is really the key thing, because if we examine our own lives, that's how we get things done. We meet people. We perhaps meet our future significant others through usually networks, meaning work networks or play networks or familial networks. That's how most of these things happen. Or other networks. Now it's online dating, but that's a network. Or Facebook is a network. And so these people are the masters of networks. They were networking long before the rest of us ever even thought of the concept. And so the Bushes are very interesting because they're not the top of the network. They're very much the sort of the worker bees almost of the network. They're people who were comfortable but who really work as kind of officers for these titans. And so if you go all the way back, you see the Harrimans, of course, E.H. Harriman, being a great railroad tycoon. And then he dies, and his sons, who are very young, Averill and Roland Harriman, inherit this whole thing, and they've got this great fortune now, and they want to diversify it. They go off to Yale, and at Yale they join a secret society called Skull and Bones, and in Skull and Bones is a fellow named Prescott Bush. Now, he's from a family that is connected but is on a lower level. His father was Samuel Bush, was in the railroad business, but at a lower level. But the father got to know Rockefellers and Harrimans and so forth, manufacturing railroad equipment. And at the start of World War One, Samuel Bush, so you're talking about the great-grandfather of W., was appointed through his more powerful friends to be in charge of small arms procurement for the war effort. Then a lot of that business went to companies like Remington Arms, which were again owned by big blocks of stock owned by people like the Rockefeller family and what have you. And then brothers of theirs were in the railroad business employing Samuel and so forth. So you see this pattern of them being sort of retainers. And then you see intermarriage. And so Prescott Bush is in Yale. He's in Skull and Bones with these Harriman sons. And then they graduate, and he marries, very interesting story there, a whole separate tale. He marries a man named George Herbert Walker, who is one of the largest financiers and bankers and investment bankers and stockbrokers outside of the East Coast, outside of Wall Street. It's located in St. Louis. And this guy is huge. Even though he's almost forgotten today, he was doing business all over the world. So he marries this guy's daughter, and then his buddies, the Harriman boys, draft George Herbert Walker to move to New York and to take over the running of all of their investments. And so begins this whole new enterprise that eventually becomes the investment banking firm of Brown Brothers Harriman, an outfit with interests all over the world that was before that company was constituted in its final form, was relying on the U.S. government and the U.S. military very much to protect their assets. The Marines would go into places like Nicaragua and what have you to push out presidents who were not doing their bidding. And so you begin to see the outlines of this sort of interventionist policy in the service of private wealth that controls natural resources all over the world, a situation that continues to the very present moment.
There's a famous quote by General Smedley Butler, a Marine general and two-time winner of the Congressional Medal of Honor. And in fact, he was testifying before Congress and testifying about, among other things, his recruitment by some of these power brokers to try to overthrow Franklin Delano Roosevelt. And he said, basically, he described himself as a highly paid gangster for various corporate interests on Wall Street, and he specifically mentioned Brown Brothers Harriman by name. And Walker is a powerful family. Maybe one of the only things that we see today carrying the Walker name is the Walker Cup. You mentioned that George Herbert Walker was instrumental in bringing the game of golf to the United States, the preferred sport of the power elite. One of the things, by the way, we are interviewing, if you've just joined us, we're interviewing Russ Baker, the author of the remarkable book Family of Secrets, subtitled The Bush Dynasty, America's Invisible Government, and the Hidden History of the Last 50 Years. And one of the things, one of the aspects of networking that you illustrate in a very compelling fashion, and that is the relationship between national security matters, political matters, and again, the all business. Now, the Harrimans spawned a company which will figure very prominently in the investigation that you have downloaded in Family of Secrets and that we'll be talking about in future interviews. Tell us about Brown Brothers and how they spawned Dresser Industries.
Right. Well, that's a whole other story we could do a show on. But basically, in a lot of cases, what they were doing was they were taking over other companies that had some kind of a monopoly. And Dresser Industries was a company that got in the 19th century got into the petroleum business very, very early on, providing crucial non-oil drilling services. Couplers for pipelines and things that you needed in order to be able to secure your wells and so forth. The same thing that they are still doing. There were a number of different mergers and things under the name Halliburton today, and this is talk about what's in the news, the blowout of the BP platform in the Gulf of Mexico, one of the companies in there, Halliburton, and so Dresser would later on merge with several different companies, Halliburton and Brown and Root, another very, very important firm, an engineering firm that is also known as, with the division as KBR, and they're one of the biggest defense contractors in Iraq and Afghanistan. So what was going on 100 years ago is still very much going on today. We don't talk about these things. We don't understand them, and unfortunately, we in the media tend not to cover them.
Dresser Industries was a spinoff, so to speak, and we should note that Prescott Bush went to work for Brown Brothers Harriman. And you mentioned that one of the Harrimans, I think it was E. Roland Harriman, sort of pointed to a fellow and said, Dresser Industries, or Dresser. And that was a fellow who, I don't know if one could actually describe him as the godfather, perhaps not in a strict sense, but maybe in a corporate slash generational sense, the professional godfather of George Herbert Walker Bush. And that is a fellow named Henry Neal Mallon. Tell us a little bit about Henry Neal Mallon and Dresser Industries.
Right. Well, he was another one of these friends from Yale. And with all of them, by the way, have these sort of murky periods in their resumes where they, in the case of Mallon, he purportedly went off for a while climbing in the Alps. They're basically blank spots on their resumes, and then they resurface and suddenly appointed to these important positions. And Mallon again, the skull and bones tie. So he comes back from this trip, and he comes in to visit his buddies, the Harrimans and Prescott, and according to this story, they're all sitting around deciding what to do with this Dresser Industries company that they had just bought. When they spotted him, he walked in the door, and immediately, as you point out, Roland said, Dresser, you know, and that this guy could run Dresser. And so they take this fellow with really lacking the qualifications to run that company, and he's put in charge of it. Dresser begins growing very, very rapidly, and in the build-up to World War II and the conversion of the economy to a wartime economy, a lot of these manufacturing companies started gearing up to get military contracts. Dresser began gobbling up lots of these firms. And in Family of Secrets, I tell this story because this gets us into the early days of George H.W. Bush, or his nickname Poppy, who was the 41st president of the United States.
Russ Baker, let me interrupt briefly. Yeah. What is the genesis of that nickname? I know he got it, I think, at Andover, maybe Yale. I've never heard about anything about how that...
It was because his name was the same as his maternal grandfather, George Herbert Walker. They called him Pop. And so he also looked like him as a child, and so the other kids started calling him Poppy.
Okay, I've never heard that discussed. Go ahead, Dresser Industries and the young Poppy.
Yeah, and so he, you know, he goes off to Yale, and he goes into, again, Skull and Bones. And I just want to stop for a second to say that, because, of course, we could do a whole program just on that. What are these entities? What are these secret societies? Well, you know, there's all sorts of irresponsible speculation on the Internet. There are a number of pretty bad books out there that are selling extremely well that purport to offer the inside secrets. And all I can say is it's enough for me that the people who joined them considered them to be important enough to join and important enough to preserve whatever secrecy they were sworn to. And if you flash forward to the 2004 election, you have George W. Bush, also a member of Skull and Bones, the Republican nominee, the Democratic nominee, John Kerry, also a member of Skull and Bones. And you have to keep in mind that it's just a handful of people in there each year. And so it's a very small and select group. In any case, so all these guys are in this organization. A lot of them seem to have familial connections to the intelligence apparatus of the United States. And by the way, that apparatus far predates the CIA, because there were always spies. Every empire has spies, and we had spies, you know, back in the Revolutionary War, and then throughout much of the history of the country, the principal mechanism for international spying was, well, to some extent, it was diplomats and private business people, but it was also the Navy and naval intelligence. And if you look at the Bush family, they served in naval intelligence, and so all these people then go into these elite schools like Yale and so forth, into these secret societies, and then they emerge from them into training in their various so-called family businesses. And in the case of George H.W., or we'll call him Poppy Bush, he joins, as you pointed out, Dresser Industries, which is now basically owned by and run by their company, Brown Brothers Harriman. He goes in there and he supposedly is doing low-level things, painting fences and being a salesman and so on. But as I point out in Family of Secrets, it looks to be cover for some kind of intelligence training. And very quickly you see him doing things that suggest that, including shepherding people from the East Bloc who've come out there for a visit. He disappears for periods of time and so forth. And then he starts his own company, a little oil company out in West Texas, a very unimportant little known company, which miraculously begins to have huge amounts of money being pumped in by figures in Washington, like Mr. Graham, the owner of the Washington Post. And that's a whole other story about the connections between those powerful media families and this intelligence oil financial establishment.
There's a book that complements yours, and in fact, you, in Family of Secrets, Russ Baker, you actually footnoted a couple of times, and I think for people that would like to gain some depth, after they've bought and read Family of Secrets, check out a book called The Old Boys by Burton Hearst, subtitled The American Elite and the Origins of the CIA, because I think it not only illustrates networking, again, not conspiracy theory, but networking to a very fine extent, it also shows how these networks in the intelligence community, one talks about a spy network or an espionage network, how they work in conjunction with powerful corporate elements of the American power elite. Skull and Bones, just I want to touch briefly on Skull and Bones. It has been stigmatized in some of the worst ways by the conspiracy milieu. It's just one of a number of power centers that the power elite, as C. Wright Mills call it, use for networking. You also have the supper clubs at Princeton. The American power elite and the Bushes epitomize that in many ways are Episcopalian. There's a very fine book, another one people can use, called The Power of Their Glory. It's by a couple of authors. Their last names are Conoliga, K-O-N-O-L-I-G-E. And two other things very quickly. You touched on Halliburton and the fact that they absorbed Dresser Industries and that they were involved with the blowout of the oil rig in the Gulf of Mexico. Another company that you talk about networking with the Bushes, networking with George W. Bush, networking with Tony Blair, the Gamel family. Am I pronouncing that right?
Not as
Gamel. British Petroleum. I don't know if we'll have time to get into that, but BP is part of this networking as well. Last point, a lot of people wonder about naval intelligence and why it's so important. Once upon a time, sail was the main vehicle for not only transportation and shipping, literally, but also communication between continents, and much of the primacy of naval intelligence in the Navy in these matters stems from that. Jumping back to George Bush in the Navy, you mentioned that he was involved with a photo reconnaissance group, so that even when he was in the Navy, he was involved with intelligence. So highlight that for us, if you would, Russ.
Right. I mean, this is the early training. In other words, in the books, you see, Family of Secrets has only been even heard of by a certain select group of people because, I mean, frankly, the revelations in there are, I'm afraid, a little bit too provocative for mainstream reviewers, for some of the large television shows and so on. And I've been told that privately by them. They're saying, we love you, we know your credentials, but, you know, I got to keep my job. And so what they do instead is they have people on there, like, you know, Karl Rove talking about his book, very mainstream historians with theirs and so on. And these mainstream accounts, for example, let's say about the life of Poppy Bush, George H.W. Bush 41, is that, you know, he was one of the youngest people who enlisted, you know, voluntarily in World War II and became, you know, a bomber pilot, you know, leaving out really not really looking at what he did, which was that he got into intelligence work, and he was doing, as you say, the aerial surveillance. This was top secret classified work. He was involved with a group of people that were connected to the operation in Asia. That's where he was with General MacArthur, who had his own intelligence force, the OSS, which we think of as the prime military intelligence entity in World War II, was operating mostly in, but not exclusively, in Europe. That MacArthur basically told them to stay out, and there was a back relationship between MacArthur again and all of these people, as I relate in Family of Secrets. If you go far enough back, let me see if I have this right. MacArthur's father was a governor of the basically what was then a colony, the Philippines, when the United States was extracting tremendous amounts of natural resources out of that, and there was a request by MacArthur's mother to the Harrimans, would you give our son a job? And so you see these kind of networks, again, going all the way back, tying in again to these natural resources and again to intelligence and again to war making.
Russ, we are almost, and let me jump in. We're almost out of time on this side, but we've got another half hour to go. And as I figured, we were just going to barely scratch the surface of your remarkable book. The book at whose author we are interviewing is Family of Secrets, subtitled The Bush Dynasty, America's Invisible Government, and the Hidden History of the Last 50 Years. The author is Russ Baker. It's now out in softcover by the Bloomsbury Press. Russ, give us your website, and then we're going to move to side two.
Okay, two different websites for the book. It's familyofsecrets.com. And we don't keep it up like we should, but we occasionally put up, perhaps we'll put this show up there, links to prior interviews and so forth. And then another site, whowhatwhy.com, whowhatwhy.com. That is our new nonprofit investigative reporting site where we are continuing to look into these big questions of how does power work and how do these decisions get made that affect our lives. It's a nonprofit, and it is based entirely on the financial support of the public.
Want to hear more? Stay tuned for Side 2 of For the Record program number 711, interview with Russ Baker, author of Family of Secrets. This concludes Side 1. This has been recorded on May 23rd of the year 2010. For Russ Baker, this is Dave Emery saying thanks for listening.